And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I'm in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to ask you if you could please have a pencil and paper handy, because I know there's something that I'm going to say in the next half hour that you're going to want to write down. You're going to want to take some notes, maybe go to a web page, click on an action button, something like that. Maybe even write a letter. Maybe think about it. Or you could get out and do something, because the California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team, is going to be having a restoration this Saturday, December 6th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Natural Bridges State Park. We'll be continuing our work on ice plant eradication on the dunes. Fall migration is in full swing, and this park is an excellent spot to see many known and unknown species. Bring a pair of binoculars if you have them. The rain is here. See you out there. How do you get there? Well, take Highway 1 or Mission Street, whichever you want, north through Santa Cruz. Continue to Swift Street. Take a left. Go to the end. Take a right. Park is at the end of West Cliff Drive. Park your car in the street parallel to the entrance to the park and walk in. Meet by the sand parking lot on your left, just past the fee kiosk. You won't have to pay anything. That's this Saturday, December 6th at 10 a.m. Natural Bridges State Park. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. The program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Wear comfortable layered clothing. Bring something to drink and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. But if things get particularly unpleasant, they call it a day. Saturday might be a nice day. Tools are provided. Bring your gloves and some water. If you have any questions, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. Area code 831-462-4041. Or email her at redwoodrn, that's REDWDRN, at packbell.net. Or visit their website, www.cruzcnps.org. That's CRUZCNPS.org. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. Winter seems to be coming and going, but it will soon be here in earnest. Volunteers have been in the field every day checking migration corridors and looking for any sign of wild buffalo migrating into Montana. Another bull was recently killed by a state hunter in the Gardner Basin north of Yellowstone National Park. His death means that, again, there are no wild bison in Montana. This is the goal for those who administer these so-called hunts. It's a canned hunt, a border shoot, killing wild bison that migrate over Yellowstone's boundary into Montana. There's very little habitat they are allowed to use outside the park, so when they do emerge, it is extremely easy for hunters to find and kill them. Tremendous amounts of habitat are available, but with the current management scheme, the buffalo are forbidden to use it, save for the 6 months the state and treaty hunters have seasons open to kill them. You can change this fate for wild buffalo by visiting the website to take action. I'll give you that website in a second. And by continuing to support the efforts of the Buffalo Field Campaign to be on the front lines bearing witness and defending the buffalo in court and policy arenas. Please volunteer. Buffalo warriors are needed for the approaching field season. Buffalo Field Campaign has seasonal openings for field volunteers. We have opportunities for every season, but we are in great need of folks during our field season, which runs from mid-November through May, and they're in the middle of it now. This is when wild bison are migrating into Montana. Any buffalo within Montana's borders are in danger of being shot on sight, hazed, or captured, and shipped to the slaughterhouse. All volunteers are provided room, board, gear, and training. We cater to most any dietary need and respect vegan and vegetarian diets. They also eat meat. We are located in a warm log cabin by beautiful Hebgen Lake, just a few miles outside of West Yellowstone, Montana. Check the website for details. I must repeat that one. If you're going to volunteer, check the website for details. Give them a call, and we'll see you on the front lines. Buffalo Field Campaign, send your donations to P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana. The zip code is 59758. Once again, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. Area code 406-646-0070. Give a call, ask for Mike. 406-646-0070. And if you need to find out this information or anything else about the Buffalo Field Campaign, go to their website at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. The Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And we don't do this very often, and when we do, it's extremely sad. And in this case, it's a longtime earth warrior who has passed away. Martin Litton has died at the age of 97. Who was Martin Litton? Well, you can thank him for saving the West. He was a passionate wilderness conversationalist. In this obituary written by Bettina Boxall for the L.A. Times, as found on the Earth First Newswire. As a boy growing up in the 1920s, when California's population was less than 5 million, Martin Litton would hike cross-country from his Inglewood home to the beach. Sometimes he accompanied his veterinarian father on his rounds to the ranch that later became the Los Angeles International Airport. Litton spent summers camping with his family in Yosemite National Park. As a teen, he and a friend rented a burro for 75 cents a day and climbed Mount Whitney. On that 12-day trip into the wilderness, they didn't need to get reservations either. They never saw another person. That was the thing that changed my life, Litton would recall decades later. Litton, 97, a legendary Colorado River guide and fierce wilderness advocate involved in some of the 20th century's biggest conservation battles, died Sunday of age-related causes at his home in Portola Valley, California. A pilot, an oarsman, a writer, a photographer, Litton was above all a passionate defender of the wild. He was an environmental purist who disdained compromise, a master of what a contemporary called articulate outrage. He played a pivotal role in keeping dams out of his beloved Grand Canyon and a ski resort out of the Southern Sierra's majestic mineral King Valley. He was a leading force in the establishment of Redwood National Park and fought a bitter losing battle against the construction of a nuclear power plant at Diablo Canyon on the California coast. The preeminent conservationist David Brower called Litton his conscience. When I would waver in various conservation battles, he would put a little starch in my backbone by reminding me that we should not be trying to dicker and maneuver, Brower said. I guess I got some of my extremism from Martin Litton, and I'm grateful for it. Litton was as unyielding to age as he was to those who would destroy the wild. He continued to crusade, pilot his vintage Cessna airplane, row a dory through the Grand Canyon, and enjoy a good martini well past his 90th birthday. With a powerful voice and strong features wreathed in a white beard and soaring eyebrows, he remained a commanding presence. He was a no-nonsense, fearless, would always speak truth to power, Bruce Hamilton, deputy executive director of the Sierra Club, said Monday. He had a way with words, a way with photographs, just a way of shaming people into doing the right thing. Litton served on the board of the Sierra Club from 1964 to 1972. As an ally of Executive Director Brower, he challenged the organization's gentlemanly old guard, persuading, some would say bullying, the board into reversing its position and opposing the Mineral King ski area development. He made sure the club didn't acquiesce to government proposals to erect two dams on the Colorado in the Grand Canyon. If I hadn't done what I did, I think it's very likely at least one of those dams would have been put in the canyon. I was the only one screaming about them, Litton said in a 2011 interview with the Los Angeles Times. Like Brower, he regretted that he had not fought harder against the upriver construction of Glen Canyon Dam. I knew it was a beautiful place. There were just so many things to be concerned about. It had to take a back seat, and that's too bad. Clyde Martin Litton was born February 13, 1917, in Los Angeles. He launched his first environmental crusade while he was still a student at the University of California, Los Angeles, where he met his future wife, Esther Cluett. Litton and some friends formed a group called California Trails to keep roads out of wild places. They succeeded in stopping a highway that would have sliced through the Sierra to connect Lone Pine and Porterville. The area eventually became the Golden Trout Wilderness. He majored in English because he thought it would be easy. After graduating in 1939, he worked briefly as a teacher in a public relations at an Arizona resort, then got a job as a part-time tour guide at the L.A. Times. After World War II, during which he served as a glider pilot in the Army Air Force, he returned to the L.A. Times in the circulation department. That job kept him on the road a lot, and when Litton came across an interesting story, he freelanced it for the paper. The Times paid him $10 for a photo and 75 cents a column inch. Before long, he was writing articles with pointed environmental themes, making no attempt at impartiality, as he warned of government dam-building plans that would flood parts of Dinosaur National Monument and the Grand Canyon. Vividly written and illustrated with his photos, the articles caught the attention of David Brower, who enlisted Litton to contribute to Sierra Club publications. When Sunset Magazine was looking for a travel editor, Brower recommended Litton, who moved to the San Francisco Bay Area to take the job in 1954. The magazine shied away from controversy, so Litton, who became senior editor, used pseudonyms in his club work, including photos published in Time and the River Flowing, the crusading 1964 book on the Grand Canyon. That same year, he was elected to the Sierra Club's executive board. He was soon stirring things up. "I sort of ran my own course while in the Sierra Club," Litton recalled in a series of interviews with club figures conducted by the Oral History Project at UC's Berkeley's Bancroft Library. "I didn't feel cooperation even within the club was necessary. I thought dissent and ferment, or whatever you want to call it, might be essential." Several avid skiers were on the Sierra Club's board, which was preparing to support Walt Disney Productions' proposal to fill Mineral King's mountain bowls and valleys with downhill ski trails and a year-round resort. A new road to the development would have cut through the nearby Sequoia National Park. "I stood up in outrage and said, 'How dare you? How dare anybody even to think about this?'" Litton said. "I remember longtime board member Ansel Adams saying, 'I don't know the road was going to be in the national park.' I said, 'All you have to do is look at the map, dumbhead.' The board reversed its position, fought the proposal, and Mineral King was never developed. The area was later added to Sequoia National Park." Alternately eloquent, charming, and abrasive, Litton alienated some on the board, which in the 1960s was divided between warring pro- and anti-Brower camps. Litton wasn't much of a smoker, but during board meetings he would sometimes puff away on big cigars just to annoy people. "There was always something about Martin that was thoroughly exercised about, or he could be brutal in his remarks," fellow director William Seary said at the Bancroft Library interviews. "Martin was never the environmental statesman, but he was fascinating as a speaker. He used colorful phrases, analogies, and metaphors, and they were often cutting, sometimes irresponsible. He never pulled his punches. He was never inhibited. If he felt something, he just said it." Litton, who rode crew at UCLA, first floated down the Grand Canyon in 1955 with a group that included his wife. At that point, fewer than 200 people were known to have made the trip. Litton had dislocated his shoulder and so was just a passenger, but he was hooked. The next year he rode through the canyon, and until he was in his early 90s, returned again and again to ride the Colorado's heaving, stormy rapids, which he called the best in the world. His river passion grew into a full-time job after he quit Sunset Magazine in a huff in 1968 because publisher Bill Lane killed an article he had written about acreage omitted from the new Redwood National Park. He founded Grand Canyon Dories and until the late 1980s ran commercial trips through the canyon in nimble wooden boats he and a friend had adapted from the Northwest River Dory. Litton's big hands were most comfortable wrapped around dory oars or at the controls of a small plane. He had piloted gliders loaded with troops and equipment during Allied invasions in Europe. Decades later, he would fly politicians and journalists in his vintage Cessna, skimming over redwoods or landscapes that needed saving, expounding on the glories of nature untamed. "Nature has its rights," he once said. "It has a right to be there untrammeled, unfettered. Man doesn't have to screw everything up." Litton is survived by his wife Esther, children John, Donald, Kathleen, and Helen, and there are 5 grandchildren and 4 great-great-grandchildren. Martin Litton, dead at the age of 97. Leading scientists, 200 groups and companies call for the protection of monarch butterflies in this story from the Center for Biological Diversity as found on the Earth First Newswire. In the face of staggering declines of monarch butterflies, more than 40 leading monarch scientists and ecologists and 200 organizations and businesses have urged Interior Secretary Sally Jewell to protect the butterflies under the Endangered Species Act. The letters come in support of a formal petition to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service seeking federal protection for monarch butterflies. The petition was filed in August by the Center for Biological Diversity, the Center for Food Safety, the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation, and the renowned monarch scientist Dr. Lincoln Brower. The North American monarch butterfly population has declined by 90% in the past 20 years, dropping from a high of approximately 1 billion insects in the mid-1990s to fewer than 35 million butterflies last winter, the lowest number ever recorded. The dramatic decline is being driven by the loss of milkweed plants, the monarch caterpillar's only food, caused by increased pesticide use resulting from the widespread planting of genetically engineered crops in the Midwest, where most monarch butterflies are born. Quote, the extensive use of herbicide glyphosate on genetically engineered crops has all but wiped out milkweed in crucial monarch breeding areas. If we have any hope of saving monarchs, our agricultural practices must be at the forefront of conservation, unquote, said Larissa Walker, pollinator program director at the Center for Food Safety. Again, quoting, the monarch butterfly is North America's most well-known and cherished insect, unquote, said Serena Jepson, endangered species program director at the Xerces Society. Again, quoting, without immediate protection to protect this species and restore critical milkweed habitat, the spectacular migration of the monarch butterfly may no longer be an experience for future generations to enjoy, unquote. Again, quoting, the Endangered Species Act is the most effective tool available for spurring the large-scale effort that's needed to protect the amazing monarch butterfly from extinction, unquote, said Tierra Curry, senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity. And activists are monitoring hound hunting and the snaring of wolves in Wisconsin for illegal activity. The story from the Wolf Patrol, as found on Earth First Newswire. With the beginning of the hound hunt for wolves in Wisconsin, the wildlife advocacy group Great Lakes Wolf Patrol is continuing its monitoring of the wolf hunt, with 9 members patrolling areas open to hound hunting for illegal activity and snaring. In October, the Great Lakes Wolf Patrol conducted an investigation into Wisconsin wolf trapping, which resulted in documentation of an illegal wolf trap in Douglas County. The evidence was turned over to Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources, which conducted its own investigation and concluded that the documented wolf trap was indeed illegal. On November 20th, Great Lakes Wolf Patrol met with Department of Natural Resources Chief Warden Tom Scheller and other enforcement personnel to discuss the trapping investigation. Great Lakes Wolf Project's Patrol's monitoring project and the upcoming hound hunt for wolves. Patrol members reviewed hound hunting guidelines and informed DNR officials that while GLWP advocates for a total ban on hound hunting of wolves, we intend to only gather video and photographic documentation of the wolf hunt to be used to educate the public and legally fight for a complete ban on the hound hunting of wolves. We believe that this hunt is unethical and against all manner of fair chase. This isn't a hunt, it's another DNR-approved policy of running down wildlife with dogs, said Rod Coronado, the founder of the Great Lakes Wolf Patrol. Great Lakes Wolf Patrol has also been informed that Wisconsin's wolf hunt will not end when the statewide quota reaches 150, as was earlier reported, but will be allowed to continue until the remaining open areas, zones 3 and 6, have filled their individual quotas, respectively 40 and 35. The major reason for GLWP's presence in the hound hunt is because legal wolf kills are exceeding predetermined quotas, such as in Zone 2, where the quota was 15, but allowable kills were 29. I don't understand that, but maybe we can figure that out later. In the meeting with Department of Natural Resources, patrol members were told the agency has no clear idea how many hound hunters will be out in the field on opening day of the hound hunt. Our presence is intended to not only document the hunt, but to also patrol hound hunters for illegal hunting practices, such as hunting with no more than the legally allowed 6 hounds, or allowing their dogs to bite or attack wolves. Great Lakes Wolf Patrol's monitoring locations will vary depending on hounding locations, but will continue until Wisconsin's wolf hunt officially ends. Patrol members will then provide the public and the Department of Natural Resources with our findings. DNR enforcement officials also told GLWP members that during our October wolf trap monitoring project, they did not receive a single complaint, and that the DNR relies on the eyes and ears of citizens such as the Great Lakes Wolf Patrol to investigate illegal hunting activities in Wisconsin. And minks have been freed from a fur farm in Italy. This story was received anonymously and roughly translated, as found in Biteback and the Earth First Newswire. When we learned of a liberation in August of this year, we decided once again to visit the small mink ranch in Scorze, Italy, on the night of October 25th. Our purpose was to see if the farmer in question had made the decision to close his business of animal torture. Our visit instead found 2 out of 3 structures full of mink, in some cases more than 1 mink per cage. We cut as much of the fence as possible and opened all the cages, destroying many of them. The large number of animals on the farm suggests that after the previous liberation, many may have been recaptured in the countryside, but it is also very likely that new animals were purchased by the farmer so that he would not be forced to close down. Both hypotheses should not be discouraging, but should instead lead to other thoughts far away from resignation and the passivity of inaction. In this release, the animals fleeing the cages seem to already know where to run to freedom with an energy that usually takes time to develop given the conditions of captivity, an energy and will that cannot be missed even by those who believe the cages should no longer exist. Our goal was not to detect any irregularities within this system. The dismemberment of bodies for skins, vivisection, slaughter, and other things are not abnormalities, but are the normal operation of this social machine, which makes the dismemberment of bodies a normal procedure. When we open the cages, we are well aware of this. By opening the cages, you break with the existing fact of perpetual exploitation of animals endlessly bred by the farmer. This action represents freedom for those who are released, but also for those free. Those who flee to freedom do not come back of their own free will and often prefer death. A piece of freedom can be a beginning to try and create more and more, not indefinitely, but until the twisting of this system of death. These days, 13 years ago, Barry Horn died in England, a liberator of animals, a saboteur of structures of exploitation, because of a long hunger strike aimed at ending vivisection in England. We want to end these lines in his memory and dedicate this small piece of freedom that we created when the locks were broken and the cages were opened again. Signed, the Animal Liberation Front. Our next story, the Muir Woods coho salmon vanish, fanning fears of extinction. The story written by Paul Fimwright of the San Francisco Chronicle. Cherished coho salmon that historically wriggled their way past beachgoers up Redwood Creek into Muir Woods vanished this year and are now on the verge of extinction, prompting a last-ditch effort by fisheries biologists to save the genetically unique species. No salmon eggs were spotted in the shade of the world-famous Redwood Grove this past winter, and not a single baby coho could be found this summer. The situation was so bad in August that 105 juvenile salmon had to be removed from the creek and brought to a hatchery. It's a crisis in terms of this kind of intervention has never happened before. In Redwood Creek, said Laura Cheriton, director of the Watershed Alliance of Marin. Historically, these fish evolved in this watershed, so it could be the beginning of local extinction or extirpation. State fisheries biologists believe that the 2014 generation of the beleaguered species is extinct, although their demise has not yet been confirmed. The Redwood Creek coho are done in, officials said, by decades of environmental pollution and habitat degradation combined with the current drought. We believe the persistent drought and restricted access into the creek could have been the last straw, said Manfred Kittle, the regional coho salmon recovery coordinator for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. When abundance is already so low, any little thing can wipe out the year class. The spawning run isn't expected to be any better this winter. Fewer than 10 fish returned to spawn in 5 of the past 7 years, not including 2014. In 2011 and 2013, only 8 spawning coho were counted in Redwood Creek. The 8.9 square mile Redwood Creek watershed is the historic home of the southernmost continually returning natural population of coho salmon in the western United States. Coho, which are also known as silver salmon, were once so plentiful that Miwok Indians used the area as a seasonal fishing village, competing with the local grizzly bears for the bounty. The fish thrived in a network of wetlands, dunes, and 13-acre open freshwater lagoon. Over the past century, the creek was forced into a narrow channel as road construction, agriculture, and recreation eliminated the natural floodplain. Although coho have been disappearing throughout their range, the decline in Redwood Creek has been precipitous. Things were looking so bleak last winter that fish and wildlife biologists got together with experts from the National Marine Fisheries Service, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the National Park Service, and state parks to discuss the situation. The group decided to rescue all the baby fish in the creek and raise them in a hatchery. The problem was, there were no baby fish left in August when biologists went to collect them. Instead, they removed 105 smolts, which Kittle said should have already migrated out to the ocean in preparation for their return in 18 months. He believes that the juvenile coho got stuck in inland waters because of low water. The coho spawning runs last winter were dismal all up and down the coast. All the creeks were blocked by sandbars until late January and February because of the lack of rain. Only a small number of coho reached their native streams before the rain stopped and the sandbars were exposed again. The surprising thing was that we didn't find any fish that were born this year, young fish about 6 or 7 months old, which indicates to us there was no successful reproduction this past winter, Kittle said. So the very thing we were trying to prevent, the year class extinction, may have happened in the very year that we initiated this captive breeding program. The surviving fish were brought to the Warm Springs Hatchery in Sonoma County, where they will be raised to adulthood and returned to the creek during the winter of 2015-16 when they are 3 years old. The calamity this year doesn't mean the endangered coho are gone forever, but the overall situation is dire. Coho return from the ocean to the streams where they were born at age 3 to spawn and die. The 3-year coho life cycle means that although the 2014 population may be gone, there are 2 more generations, one of which would normally begin swimming up Redwood Creek around now after the first heavy rains. 2 out of those 3-year classes were very close to becoming extinct before this year, Kittle said. There were only a handful of adults coming back from those year classes. In 2012, 50 coho spawned in the creek, the best return in the past 3 years, but nothing compared to the 180 spawners that they had in 2004. Those 50 salmon are from the same year class as the 105 juvenile fish that had to be taken out of the creek last August, meaning that generation, too, could be in trouble, Cheriton said. The whole thing is all the more troubling to conservationists in light of the recent restoration of the historic marshlands and tidal lagoon at Muir Beach, which was supposed to be a bonanza for coho. The $15 million project by the National Park Service and the nonprofit Golden Gate National Parks Conservancy included the rerouting of the ocean into the ocean of the creek, which flows from Mount Tamalpais through Muir Woods past the Cozy Pelican Inn and out to Muir Beach. Kittle said the idea now is to restore salmon populations, possibly by mixing fish from other watersheds with the 105 fish taken from Redwood Creek. Genetic diversity of the fish population is a major concern, he said. These year classes are very small, and they have gone through a genetic bottleneck, meaning there is a good likelihood that they are suffering from some inbreeding, he said. By mixing in other fish populations, you would have the genetic effect of counteracting this inbreeding. Either way, he said, the fish in the hatchery represent an insurance policy against further extinctions and may be crucial in the quest to rebuild a lost generation of fish. I see it as a very interesting combination of having a huge problem with the threat of imminent extirpation of the species, coupled with an opportunity to solve the problem, Kittle said. It's a great restoration and recovery opportunity. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for news this week on the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to hear a rebroadcast, tune in tomorrow afternoon at Free Radio at 3 o'clock on Fridays. We are at 101.3 FM and also at www.freakradio.org. If you're in Moscow, Idaho, tune in to Radio Free Moscow 90.3 KRFP at 9:30 p.m. on Mondays. Or if you're in Edmonton, near Calgary, Alberta, tune in to Free Radio Edmonton, YEG Radio at WordPress.com. They rebroadcast this show 2 p.m. Saturdays and 10 a.m. Sundays, Mountain Time. Or you could go to radioforall.net and listen online or download the latest or any previous Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.